park just outside your doorway. So get outside and find it in the Maine outdoors. Fishing and hunting, winter, spring, summer, and fall. If it happens in the Maine outdoors, they talk about it all. Just tune in your radio to 103.9. Jim and Paul and Bob and Matt are your outdoors online. Each Sunday night at 7 on WVOM. To find out what is happening, just listen to the radio to the Maine outdoors.
Welcome to the Maine Outdoors. Here's tonight's host, V. Paul Reynolds.
And once again, Paul is still in Florida, although slowly making his way northward. My name is Erin Merrill. I am your host tonight. My third time hosting the Maine Outdoors this winter, spring. And I am happy to have Norm here on the boards with me. Norm, how are you doing tonight?
Good, Erin. Yourself? How you been?
I am well.
How are things in Augusta?
Oh, they're going. They're going. We were talking prior to the show about all of the traffic that I had to endure on my way up thanks to the eclipse that's happening tomorrow, and how many out-of-staters there are on the roads right now. Fun times.
I imagine the Houlton area is going to get bombarded.
I'm sure.
Because Houlton's going to be the epicenter, I think, of the eclipse.
So. Yeah. I hope everybody that has a skidder is ready in case there are people that are going on the roads where they're not supposed to be. But it's all good. We are coming to you live from WVOM 103.9 in Bangor, WVQM 101.3 in Augusta, and 94.1 in Rockland. And we have a phenomenal guest. I figured I'd go out on a high note this year. The guest tonight is the one and only Jim Shockey.
Yes, this is great. I've seen quite a few of his YouTube videos. Really impressed with the caliber of the hunts that he does and the areas he's hunting in. It's really neat. It's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. So if you have a question and you would like to call in, the number is 1-800-966-1039, or feel free to shoot me a message on Instagram or Facebook, and we'll be able to get that hopefully to Jim. And if not, I can always do a follow-up article on the journal or my website with any of those questions. So, anything else new and exciting happening, Norm? I know Monday officially kicked off the open water season for all of us.
Yes.
Fishermen, fisherwomen in the state.
And well, you know, late this afternoon is really neat. You know, this globe appeared in the sky. I'm saying, what is that? It's the sun.
Right. It was snowing this morning. Wow. And now it's sunny this afternoon. So we're sort of slowly getting into springtime. And hopefully the past 2 weeks and getting 18, 19, 20 inches of snow in my backyard. I'm done with that.
Kind of a Maine spring, though. I mean, you always get these late snows. I remember my wife, you know, and unless it's not at least April 20th, she says, no, just sit tight. We're going to get some more snow. And because there was one year we had like at least a foot of snow on the night of the 20th of April.
Ugh. I remember when I was in college, we got a massive snowstorm. I almost feel like it was April 1st. And the hockey team was playing in the Frozen Four, so we couldn't cancel school, because if we canceled classes, they wouldn't be able to show the game.
Right.
And so I remember I got stuck. I had to have some people push me out of the parking lot because I had to go in and teach in the afternoon. Okay. I had two sessions that day. So, yay, Maine. I'm sure Jim is so excited that he is not in the Northeast. Awesome. So we also have the Augusta Sportsman Show coming up at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. That's happening the 19th through the 22nd in Augusta at the Civic Center. That should be phenomenal. It's always fun to see everybody. And my friend Wayne from Allagash Adventures comes down with his massive buck that I think scored like 215 that he got up in Allagash. I did an article about that. So he was the one that took me out on my moose hunt. So it's always nice to see him when he comes downstate.
He had an inside job to get the moose.
I know. It was a long, exhausting hunt.
Oh, I can imagine.
But totally worth it. And so it's always nice to see everybody from around the state coming together for the shows, and then we all sort of disperse and go back to doing our thing. So, and we have turkey hunting coming up. That, like, this month pretty much starts everything for the year. So the youth get to head out into the woods April 27th, and then the rest of us head out on April 29th. And a lot of my friends that are out in Missouri, they started this weekend. It was youth weekend, and so it was nice to see a lot of girls out there, young girls out shooting turkeys and posting them on social media, which was really nice.
See, for me, it's not fair. I can get one out of my backyard.
Well, right? I know. There's so many of them. I think every time my trail camera goes off, it's either a squirrel or 40 turkeys going by. They'll disappear soon, I'm sure, but so many of them, especially with the winters that we've been having. You know, we haven't had the natural kill-off for both deer and turkey because we just haven't had any snow.
Yeah, survival rate is so much better.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe that will help our numbers and the allotments that hunters are able to take when we are able to start harvesting them. I know in the fall, the zone that I hunt in, I can take five turkeys, two in the spring and five in the fall. That's a lot of birds.
That's a lot of birds, yeah.
Yes. Good old reintroduction and the whole conservation movement, right?
You're right.
Okay. We ready to bring Jim in, even though we have to take a commercial break in a couple?
Yeah, sure. Bring him right in.
All right. Oh, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can
you hear you. Yay. So our guest tonight is Jim Shockey. And it's funny because you and I met in October when you were here at Cabela's signing your book, Call Me Hunter. And so I sort of forgot that I should have, like, pulled up your biography for anyone that's been living under a rock for the past 40 years and doesn't know who you are. According to Wikipedia, you're a Canadian outdoor writer, a professional big game outfitter and television producer, and Outdoor Life has called you the most accomplished big game hunter of the modern era, having taken arguably the most big free range big game species by any living hunter. Also noted that you are the most influential celebrity in the big game hunting industry. Wow. How's that feel?
Well, it feels like I need to change Wikipedia. Have you ever tried to change Wikipedia? I have, actually.
You've tried it?
Yeah, we tried. I tried it. Well, I mean, I love to control my own narrative.
Were you the one that put this in here?
Well, originally, a long time ago, I guess one of my team did, but I've been on them for 2 years to change it. Hunting isn't just about species and number of species. I think that Wikipedia statement is a little harsh. It's like saying you're the greatest, whale hunter that ever existed. Well, you know, whales are protected and people get the wrong impression. So I've actually tried to change it. Wikipedia says, no, we're not going to do it.
You know,
it's frightening the power they have over the narrative.
When I was teaching and we had students have to, like, actually do research for their speeches, we would not consider Wikipedia a credible source.
Yeah. Yeah, that just to let everybody know that if I paid $10,000 and got an article online from Forbes magazine, for instance, then Wikipedia would use that as a source. Well, but I paid for the source,
right?
So there's I'm not disparaging Wikipedia. Maybe I am a little bit, but not. I think there's sometimes things that are printed in there that may or may not be 100% the truth.
Sounds good to me. I believe that. But speaking of your writing career, you started out as an outdoor writer. Do you remember what your first article was about?
Yeah, I do. It was a deer hunt. It was for a magazine called Bowbender Magazine. I was an archery hunter at that time. Kathleen Windsor was the editor, and I got $42 for the article.
Awesome.
I think the title was "I Hated That Deer." It was about the ethics of hunting, if I remember correctly. I mean, it's, you know, that was 1984, so 40 years ago. So sometimes my memory isn't 100% accurate, kind of like Wikipedia.
Awesome. So you've been writing ever since, and you just published your first well, not your first book, but you published Call Me Hunter and then did a Whirlwind book tour, which is where I met you. The book is fantastic. For anyone that has not read it, I highly recommend you go pick it up. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon. It's on all the places that you would typically buy your books. And I know that you... The book ends in a way in which it's set up for a sequel. So is that on your schedule for 2024?
Yeah, I actually signed a two-book deal with Simon & Schuster in New York City. And I always felt that it was a three-book series. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I could tell the story in, you know, for sure one book or two books. So I do have to sit down and actually start writing the sequel. I mean, I could probably write it watching reruns of Laverne and Shirley. I know it's already in my head. I just need to actually take the time to do it.
Yeah.
And book writing, anyone that's a novelist out there, unless they're, you know, hugely successful Stephen King types, it pays about $1.25 an hour.
Yeah.
So, you know, to spend the next 6 months writing a novel for $1.25 an hour, yeah, I mean, have you seen the price of a Starbucks coffee recently? I'd have to write 20 books to pay for, you know, coffees for 2 years.
Right.
So I haven't done it yet, but it's for lack of time, actually.
Yeah.
Not desire. I'll get it done. I need to, because the people who read the first one want to know what happens to the characters.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I know in different interviews you have said that originally the last four chapters were not included in the manuscript. So when you look at the book, are there any other major edits that you're glad that were made prior to it being published?
Yeah, I mean, Emily Bessler was my editor. She was the best, and that's the only editor that I wanted out of all the editors out there. She's discovered many of the modern best-selling authors. So I wanted her, and she actually personally chose my book to edit, which was a wonderful pat on my back. And she's a great editor. So she probably chopped 20 pages out of my original manuscript. But because I got a little pulpity, you know, I was preaching, and I was trying to get across, you know, my philosophies on life. And really, it's kind of the outdoor field-to-table living philosophies, which are run counter to a lot of the urban perspectives on wildlife and wildlife management, you know, scientific wildlife management. So I did get a little preachy, and she cut those out. Now, you know, would I have preferred them in? Yes. Do I think it made it more saleable as a commercial entity? Yes. So she did the right thing commercially, and let's face it, any, let's see, public, you know, mainstream media, it's all commercial. I mean, it's big business making money. So,
right.
You know, she didn't want me preaching when that would alienate X amount of the potential readers of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing she took out, and was probably smart on the, you know, to put it on the bestseller list, to actually make it an international bestseller. And the four chapters, yeah, she didn't like my ending. It was a cliffhanger. And she said, well, listen, if you're James Patterson and you've published 200 bestsellers, you can do a cliffhanger and your readers will tolerate it. But
right.
You're a first-time novelist. You're not allowed to do a cliffhanger. So I had to write the first four chapters of the second book and basically tack them on to the end of the first book, just to give it some closure, some finality that wasn't there in the original manuscript. And that was smart. That I kind of agree with. I mean,
yeah.
Who do I think I am? So definitely not James Clavell or Wilbur Smith. So I better finish it. But it does still leave openings for a sequel, yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent. We are talking to Jim Shockey. If you have a question, feel free to call in at 1-800-966-1039. And we have to take a quick commercial break, and we will be right back.
More Maine Outdoors next. on 101.3 Augusta, 103.9 Bangor, 95.1 Rockland, the voice of Maine.
Okay, we are back, the Maine Outdoors. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties, but feel free to, do we have Jim back?
I can hear you, Aaron.
Yay, perfect. Yep. So, some technical errors. Oh, Norm muted himself.
Yeah, yes, we do. It's, you know, we're having the same issue as last week where somebody calls in and if I transfer it in, I won't be able to have both the caller and the guest being able to interact at the same time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to put one on hold. And
no worries.
I'm not sure how in the world that's going to work out.
So. Okay. So if anybody, since we don't want to risk losing Jim, if you would like to send us any sort of question for him, and you're on Facebook, my Facebook page is And a Strong Cup of Coffee, feel free to hop on there and shoot me a message, and I will have my phone ready to go so I can take any of those and ask him. I actually have a question from my friend Georgette. She wants to know, Jim, of all of the places that you have hunted, what's your top three favorite wild game meats?
Yes. Wild game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on how loose your definition is, the best that I've ever had is a little animal called a paca. It's a rodent that lives in South America and Central America.
Mm-hmm.
You can catch one down in Mexico, just a very southern tip Campeche area, a nocturnal, totally nocturnal, burrowing rodent. So it looks like a giant guinea pig, and they're spotted like Bambi. And by far and away, that is the best wild game meat that I've ever eaten. You know, it's a licensed game animal down there, and it's used for subsistence for many of the people that live down in those areas.
Yeah.
So it's a paca. It's a rodent, basically a large guinea pig or big rat, I guess.
Yeah.
The second would be the brush-tailed porcupine over in West Africa. Again, a burrowing animal, very, very difficult to hunt. You have to smoke them out of the burrows and basically use a shotgun as they come running out 1,000 miles an hour on one of their exits. And roast it over a fire with, you know, bullfrog legs from a place like Ghana.
Right.
It's fabulous, fabulous wild game. Now, some people might say, that's not a wild game, and they were thinking deer, turkeys, bear, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the best I've had. The third would be the access deer, which is a deer.
Mm-hmm.
And originally from Asia, I've hunted them in Pakistan and also in Hawaii, actually, is a great place to hunt access deer. And anybody that ever wants to go down there, Lanai, Pineapple Brothers, fabulous hunt. I would say that of the big game species, access deer is the best wild game meat. Now, I personally live on moose meat and caribou meat. I love it. Certainly those two would be in the top five for me, and probably elk number six and deer number seven.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
We got a couple of phone calls, and since I'm having problems trying to put them in the studio, they're leaving messages with me. So
perfect.
Let me pass a couple of them along. The first call was from a gentleman who remembers your hunt in Africa where you had armed guards with you. And I guess it wasn't to protect you from the wild game. It was from poachers. Is that correct?
You know, normally you don't need protection from the poachers. What you need protection from is the armed syndicates, their gangs that control, hire the poachers. So, for instance, in Central Africa Republic, we got ourselves in a pickle one day between the Sudanese poachers on their horseback and the herd of elephant that they were trying to kill. They just run beside them on the horses and pop them with, their 308s, I don't know what you guys call them in the States, but basically little tiny solid projectiles, and they were, you know, they're pretty aggressive because it's big money for them over there. But I've had armed guards in many places around the world, Pakistan particularly. You didn't go anywhere with out being a hard target, meaning a group of armed men ahead of you in the truck and a group behind you. You know, you had to have a 50 cal machine gun and rocket launchers, and everybody was armed to the teeth.
But
that's not protection from poachers.
Okay.
It's always people that are the threat. Poachers, for the most part around the world, they're subsistence. Hunting for subsistence, killing animals for subsistence. I don't want to call it hunting because they're not hunters. They're just trying to survive for the most part. The worst is when you get into the commercial side of it, where they're making money killing elephants and for the ivory, or hippos for the ivory, or even for meat, for selling, as opposed to just feeding their family.
Right. We had another caller from the Boston area.
Ooh.
Joe Thomas called and said that to pass on that he's very appreciative of all the work you do for conservation and, the various publications you've done and documentaries.
Yeah.
He spoke highly. So he thanks you.
Well, please tell him thank you back and tell him if I keep getting those kind of compliments, I'm not going to be able to put my cowboy hat on. My head's going to get swollen.
Well, he just heard you because he's listening live. We are, we basically transmit worldwide. So he's actually listening to the program.
All sorts of people can stream us all over the place. It's awesome. So jumping sort of back to writing, when you are writing your books, what's your ideal setup? Like, are you by yourself? Are you with noise around you? What do you free write? Do you type?
I love music in the background, but there's music plays in my home constantly. Generally modern folk music, nothing too harsh and nothing too classical and no jazz. But so I like that going in the background. I'll get up at 4 a.m, 4:30, maybe 5 at the latest, and make myself a cup of coffee and be at my computer within 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I'll sit and I'll type on a computer for, at least until noon, sometimes 2 o'clock, and then I have to get up and go do something physical, and I might, get back at it in the evening later. But it doesn't matter to me other noise going on because when I'm writing, especially a novel like that, Call Me Hunter, I am living in those characters. So I'm there. Wherever there is in the novel at that stage, that's where I am. And it's to the exclusion of everything else in the world. I don't. I don't take calls from my office. I don't, the world could be ending and I wouldn't know it. The eclipse could be happening in Maine and I wouldn't be aware of it.
I was just going to say that. The eclipse could be happening and you would just be oblivious.
Yeah, it was all news to me, actually. Just before we were on the air, you mentioned that. And, wow, Maine. I heard the weather report before I came on, and right on your radio station, they said you can look forward to sun for 3 days in a row, and then I think she said in August. So I was going, that sounds like Maine that I know.
About right. That's why I'm coming out to go bear hunting, so I can actually see some sun out there.
Well, don't count on it. The West Coast is pretty dreary at this time of year.
I'll be ready. Norm, do you want to take a break so we're back on schedule?
Sure, that'd be good.
We will be right back with Jim Shockey.
Maine Outdoors next on 101.3 Augusta, 103.9 Bangor, 95.1 Rockland, the voice of Maine.
And we are back. This is Erin Merrill on the Maine Outdoors. And I got Norm here with me, and we are on the phone interviewing Jim Shockey. I have a message from Tim Curtis that came in through my Facebook. And Tim wants to know, Jim, have you ever been on a Maine whitetail hunt or a Maine moose hunt? And would you consider it if you haven't?
Of course I'd consider it. First answer, no. I have not been whitetail hunting or bear or moose. I've never hunted Maine, but I did apply. I believe there was a draw for moose
yes.
back in the day, and I think non-residents were allowed. I don't know if they still are or not, but I absolutely applied. I don't know how many years, but I never got drawn. And then I bought my opening territory up in the Yukon, and that was, you know, pretty hard to go hunt moose anywhere else now.
Right.
But I would absolutely consider a hunt in Maine. I think it's what's the Grand Slam? You have to get a grouse.
No.
What is it?
You have to
a turkey.
A turkey.
A bear, a whitetail,
and a moose.
Turkey, bear, whitetail, and moose. Yeah.
All in the same calendar year.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty darn exciting challenge, and you know we all know the accomplishment is directly proportional to the challenge. So yeah, I would absolutely love to hunt Maine someday.
You're going to have all sorts of outfitters contacting us, trying to figure out how they get a hold of you to get you here to do that.
Yeah, it'll take a couple of years. I'm a little bit
right. Any other questions on your end, Norm, before
Nothing on my end.
Okay, what else we got? When you look back, Jim, at everywhere you've gone in the world, all the hunts that you have taken, is there a certain one that stands out as sort of being that turning point that just you went, you hunted, and you were like, this is it. This is what I want to do. This is going to be my life for so many years.
Yeah, there actually was. It was a doll sheep hunt back in the early 90s with Charlie Stricker was the outfitter, the Bonnet Plume outfitting area in the Yukon. And then, you know, that's somewhere around 5 million square acres of pure wilderness. And, I remember landing in the lake and Charlie coming up to me. The guide was a fellow named Rod Collins. And, Charlie was he was old school. He said, hold out your hands. And I said, what you mean? Like make a cup mm-hmm. with your two hands. And he poured granola into my hands, or trail mix. And I said, what's this? And he said, well, that's your food for the next 14 days.
Oh, God.
I went, okay. So I put it in a little dry bag. And that was my food. And we backpacked, Rod and I, in the most horrible, sleeting, snowing, cold, raining, windy conditions for about 7 days. And we finally found a legal ram, legal doll sheep. Mm-hmm. And legal meaning it had to be, you know, just the tip of the horn had to be over the bridge of the nose. And so it's a full curl, but it was young. You know, it was probably 6.5 years old. And you know, 6 days, I was beat up. I mean, I was eating mushrooms, wild mushrooms. I even killed a gopher and, you know, ate that and, you know, boiled it up. I was so excited to get some actual protein.
Yeah.
And I, you know, looked at that ram and I said to Rod, you know, it doesn't look that big. It looks young. And he said, yep. And he said, and you're the one that's going to have to look at it for the rest of your life and know that you compromised on your goal that you'd set when you came in here. You know, for the rest of your life, you basically know you're a quitter.
Yeah.
You're a compromiser. And so I had to turn it down. And I remember it was like a switch was flipped. And it was suddenly, I felt freed of all the fetters of I need to kill something and I can just hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I by day 10, we were like wolves. We didn't need to eat anymore. You climb the hills and you love climbing them. You didn't care if there was nothing on that mountain because there's another mountain further and another one and another one. And you hit it. It was like an epiphany where I realized I can do this.
Yeah.
I can actually do this at an elite level and I want to do this. It's a rare gift, I think, to be able to realize your potential or have the opportunity to realize your potential. And that's, I took it as that, a gift. And I determined at that point that that's what I was going to do with the remainder of my life was challenge myself in the harshest conditions, the most difficult weather and animals to hunt and places to get to. And it was really at that moment that I realized I could do it. And I just endeavored for the rest of my life to realize that potential.
It's amazing.
Got a phone call, and the person calling mentioned, you know, when you're thinking about a brown bear or grizzly hunt, what caliber would you recommend? And at the same time, which one would be the hairiest experience? or did you have one of those hairy experiences with either one of those animals?
You know, I'm a big fan of bigger is better. And there's no such thing as overkill. So I don't think that the lighter, smaller calibers, faster, are nearly as effective, especially for dangerous game, as a big, heavy caliber that's also fast would be the best. That's the perfect world. If it's got the energy is what you need. And momentum. Momentum is something they never talk about when they're talking ballistics, and especially for archery. Momentum is what passes through the animal no matter what angle it is. So if I was in a situation with a brown bear or grizzly, I mean, I use muzzlers. Who am I to talk to about this? But really, it's a pretty heavy bullet with a big diameter, and it doesn't pack a lot of energy, but again, momentum.
Right.
And if there's any rocket scientists out there, they'll tell you that that's one of the most complicated equations you can come up with. Is momentum, not just kinetic energy. So it's bigger is better. I would, if I could handle a 460 Weatherby, and I was going after brown bear, that's what I would use with big soft bullets. I'm not a big fan of 375 Holland. I know a lot of guys are screaming at me right now saying that's the best gun ever invented. Well, it probably was 1880 when it was invented, but there's far better calibers. You know, the 416 Rigbys and Remingtons and. But again, bullet construction comes into play. So it's not just as simple a question as I can't answer in 2 seconds. But
right.
The Hornady bullets that are well constructed, but depending on the game, they've got to be softer for some, harder for others.
Very true. Some have tough skin. Some of them have tough skin, and others don't. And
yep.
You got to take that in the equation when you figure out the round you're going to use.
Yeah, exactly, for the species you're after, especially dangerous animals.
Right.
As far as close calls, I've had grizzly bears come at me, to sort of full charge from 150 yards away and stop as close as 15 yards. But I've never had to shoot, not even to warn them. I honestly, because I wouldn't warn them. You know, that just introduces the possibility that I short shift the bolt and don't, jam it, so you just don't do that. It's if he's all in, I'm all in, and I'm not warning him. I'm going to kill it.
Right.
And I've had to do that with a cougar that came at me. That's actually online, and it's all on camera. I mean, it's not me blowing smoke or telling stories. It's actually documented video proof of a cougar coming out from behind me and me swinging around and shooting and killing it on its leap as it was coming at me, and from close, like 5-6 feet away. But we have had to kill grizzly bears on the steps of our cabins more than once, trying to get into the cabin to get at one of my guides one time, and actually both times it was a guide. A lady was killed in one of my camps and beside it, because there's only my camp on that remote lake and the trapper's cabin, and it was the trapper's wife and his baby were killed by a grizzly bear. So the animals, I've never had a close call. I've had them, brown bears in Alaska, come at me as well, but they phase off. They don't, it was a bluff charge. It sure doesn't feel like it when it's coming at you, but again, no, I don't warn. I warned a black bear once with a warning shot at its feet, and just got back in the boat, and it was probably a mistake, because the bear, I should have just killed it. It had a tag, it was guiding, it was perfectly legal, but it may have, I introduced the possibility that it was going to hurt somebody else, so I should have probably killed that bear, because it was not, a moment of compassion, I guess. I don't like killing animals if I there's not a real good reason for it.
Right.
And I felt if I warned them off, then that was good enough. But maybe there's a possibility that someone else might have got hurt because of that. So I have not, with a brown bear or a grizzly bear, had to even, give a warning shot across the bow. But I absolutely understand how dangerous they are. And I wouldn't give them a warning shot. I would, they're all in, then I'm all in. And my job is, the five rules are safety, 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 and safety. Mm-hmm. So the safe thing to do is kill it, not warn it.
Awesome. What do you think some of the biggest misconceptions people have about the challenges and risks of hunting?
Well, I mean, the average person out there, and let's face it, 10% of us in our population here in North America or Canada and the States, we are hunters or associated with hunters. So we understand it. We understand the challenges, the difficulties, the skills it takes, the practice, the training, the dollars it takes, the effort it takes to want to do it, the desire it takes. We understand all that.
Right.
10% of us in this, Canada and the States, we're not only non-hunters, we're against it vehemently. And so we will always endeavor to denigrate the accomplishments of hunters. We'll say it's easy, it's all high fence, they're all animals, they're just animals, and humans are using these high-power rifles. And they'll denigrate all the accomplishments of the hunters. They won't acknowledge the skills or the dollars that we put into conservation and the effort it takes to actually be a hunter.
Yeah.
The 80%, they're willing to learn to varying degrees depending on how far over towards the anti-hunting side they lean, or what they've read recently in the papers or heard on the news, or they lean towards our side. And realistic understanding of science-based wild game management. Mm-hmm. So those people understand, and I think they want to learn. I do think that there's a huge movement towards the field-to-table living where people want to learn about hunting. So, like I say, the misconceptions are mostly the stereotypes that it's easy and we're all, redneck louts that spit on the floor with no higher sensibilities.
Right.
That's probably the biggest misconception that the mainstream media continues to promulgate against every single example that we can give them. I mean, I've never met anybody like that. So, and I'm in this hunting world, the hunting industry.
Right.
So, I think that's probably of all, that's the biggest misconception.
Excellent. Awesome. We have probably 10 more minutes. So if anyone out there is listening, if you would like to ask Jim a question, the number is 1-800-966-1039, or you are more than welcome to hop on Facebook, and my Facebook page is And a Strong Cup of Coffee. Send me a message and we will try to get Jim to answer your question. We have to give a shout out real quick to Gary Coleman and the folks at General Appliance. They are located at 103 Center Street in Brewer. And as you begin to think about opening your camp up for the season, stop by and see how they can help you update your stoves, your kitchen appliances, and all those wonderful parts of your camp that may need to be replenished or restocked or refreshed for the year, including, what do we got, Norm?
The compost toilet.
Yes.
Right at the wave.
And shout out to Uncle Jim for that one.
And they do a lot of work with Gas Appliances.
Yes. So it's a perfect time to visit them and see what they have located in the spring for your new camp. Norm's taking a question. So while we are waiting for him to write down that, Jim, for people that want to get into the hunting industry, what do you think they should do? What would be like the first two or three things that they should look into, aside from everyone wanting to sort of be pro staff for all sorts of different companies? Like, are there certain things that they should or should not do if they want to become a professional hunter?
Well, if they want to do that, they can assuredly put aside any dreams of flying around in a private jet that they own or owning a yacht. I mean, you get into this industry as a professional because you love the lifestyle. And there is no greater lifestyle that I've seen. You know, I've been around a long time and seen a lot of people in a lot of different industries. And over again, they tell me from those industries that, you know, the people in our industry are really happy. And they love what they're doing. Every single day they wake up and go, wow, I have to do this for a living. So it is the greatest lifestyle, but you can put aside dreams of, you know, the rich and famous living on a 10,000 square foot house in Coronado and San Diego kind of thing. It's not going to happen. But you'll live a wonderfully satisfying and rewarding life in so many other ways, the ways that make you rich, not just financially rich. So that's the first thing they should do. The second thing is, you know, start working today, work 24/7. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can take a few hours off to sleep every night, but no weekends. Forget about watching football games on TV on the weekend. Go out there and be hunting and you know, do that, you know, forever.
Yeah.
You know, that's the next thing is it takes a work ethic. It doesn't come easily. There's no unions where that someone's going to be looking after how many hours you work, or that you don't start until this time, or you don't pick up that piece of paper because that's not your job. This is, you have to be prepared to, you know, live a selfless life to become selfish about your life.
Yeah.
It's a funny, you know, I guess, conundrum, or what do they call those things that are opposite of each other? Aaron, you're super smart. What's the word?
I can't
remember. Oxymoron. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
You know, but it's true. You have to have a work ethic if you want to be in this industry. It's not going to come easy, and everybody else will do it for virtually free.
Right.
So you've got to understand you're not going to be rich, but you'll be rich beyond imagination on the flip side of it.
Yeah. There's some pretty amazing people in this industry, which we're lucky to know and be connected with. Norm, do you have a question for us?
I know we have a phone call that came through. A gentleman is very familiar with and has watched a lot of your movies and very impressed with the work you've done. He was particularly interested in a jaguar hunt that I believe you did in, was it Central or South America?
Paraguay.
Paraguay. Okay, South America. And he was wondering if you could elaborate on what that experience was like.
Yeah, first of all, it was a green hunt. So, you know, you're going to see a lot more green hunting in the future in this world, which means darting animals for scientific studies and radio collaring them, or in the future, it's satellite collaring them. So you can actually follow what this jaguar is doing every single day, where it's moving. You can log into that jaguar. I'm planning to go to South Africa here in a few months to do that for elephants and rhinos and even two lions. It was a green hunt. You're not actually killing an animal. The purpose is to prove scientifically what the jaguars are doing on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. You know, why is it that they're killing cattle? Why did it turn into a cattle killer? Well, you find out pretty quickly it's because the habitat is being raised for cattle ranching. You know, so they don't have the habitat anymore, and that means if there's no habitat, their prey species are gone, so they have no choice. You replace the tapirs and brocket deer with cattle. So they're carnivores. They have to eat something. They don't care if it's a cow. I'm sure that they don't like the taste of or fattened up cows, but they... they need to eat something.
So, it's called survival.
Sure, yeah, of course. And every one of us would do the same thing. We'd poach a cow if we needed to. So, you know, the purpose of those studies is to help the wildlife, help people understand the need for scientific-based wildlife management, and that habitat is the problem, not hunters. So that was what this hunt was down in Paraguay. It was with Rocky McBride, who's been down there for decades now, radio collaring and now satellite collaring jaguars. So I went down to be part of his ongoing study. I actually did a paper and presented it to the Paraguayan government because they were looking at opening up hunting as using it as a wildlife management tool, which is smart.
Mm-hmm.
It's progressive thinking like that, and it's not idealistic thinking or ideological thinking. So I did a paper. I had a doctor under me and a master's student or a PhD, a master's student, and an undergrad all under me on this paper, a scientific paper that we did for the Paraguayan government, presented it to them. I think it was ICERM was the acronym that I used, basically sustainable use of wildlife management through hunting, something like that.
But, yeah.
But the darting of the jaguars was part of that project, and when we went in, the one jaguar killed three of the five dogs, I believe, or four of the six. It was a terrible tragedy, but it happens when you're trying to save something. There's going to be losses.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the dogs in this case, it was one of the saddest television shows. It was one of my Uncharted television shows that I've ever had to produce.
Oh. Okay. Well, in our we only have a couple more minutes. As you think about and sort of reflect on all of your adventures and all of your shows, what do you hope is your legacy within the hunting and conservation communities?
It's pretty simple that I would like to be remembered as somebody that helped the non-hunting public's perception of hunters and non-hunters in a positive way, to show that who we really are and what we're about. You know, we're family people. We believe in the virtues that made these countries great: honor, tradition, respect, loyalty, trust. This is what hunters and their families are all about, and I would hope that that's what I'm remembered for, is that I made a positive impact on that perception of hunters and hunters and hunting.
Awesome. I'm watching Norm for like the final countdown. Have you finished the second Paul Dwyan book? Just curious.
The second which?
The second book by Paul Dwyan.
Oh, yes, I did. Yes. Yeah, Trespasser.
Yes.
Yeah, I did.
Perfect.
Great author. I read both of them. Pretty envious of his success, obviously. He's wonderful writer. And I enjoyed both of his first two books.
Awesome. Well, I will bring the third one when I come up to go bear hunting with you next month.
Perfect.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the Maine Outdoors, Jim. I really appreciate it.
It's been really neat. I really appreciate all the work you've done, and I've watched a lot of your stuff, and very well done.
Yeah, my pleasure, and thank you. I'm getting the big fat head.
Just don't walk through any doors right now.
Right, exactly.
No, exactly. That's awesome. My shoulders that get in the way.
There you go. Thank you very much, Jim.
You betcha.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll see you all next week
on the Maine Outdoors.